Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the London Review Bookshop, where this evening we're delighted to welcome Ian Sinclair to talk about his latest book, American Smoke, published by Hamish Hamilton. It's the third part of a loose trilogy of topographical ruminations that began with Hackney, That Rose Red Empire, and Ghost Milk. In this latest volume, Ian follows the traces of the writers of the American Beat Generation, Kerouac, Burroughs, and Malcolm Lowry, amongst others. In conversation with Ian this evening is publisher and curator Gareth Evans, who, amongst other things, is currently film curator at the Whitechapel Gallery. The talk will last approximately 40 to 45 minutes. There'll be time for questions at the end. I'll be around with the microphone, so please do raise your hands and we'll try and fit everybody in. There's also a lot of books on sale this evening, including a beautifully produced limited edition of American Smoke. We don't have that on the shop floor, but I do have a leaflet here. There are plenty here. If you'd like to see a copy, please let me know at the end of the event. And with that out of the way, please join me in a very warm welcome for Ian Sinclair and Gareth Evans. Thank you very much.
Many thanks indeed, Claire. Thanks to everyone here at the London Review Bookshop for putting on this event and for asking me to be involved in moderation and conversation with Ian, which of course is a very pleasurable and easy job to undertake, given the richness of the material we're about to encounter. There's a classical mythic sense underpinning, I think, both this evening, but also the book, of course, we're about to discuss. Ian, of course, needs no introduction to London Review Bookshop visitors or to readers of the August Journal, because many of the portraits that we're about to encounter in American Smoke, a number at least, have been road tested in the pages of the journal. But, of course, the LRB is a mythic structure. It's a mythic shop. It's celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. The journal has origins lost deep in time. But the mythic underpinnings I'm thinking about are more Homeric, really. They go back to the classical realm. And not least because this publication is the 18th that Ian has published this year. And so it's a little bit like the Hydra. You buy one and another 17 pop up to replace the one you've just bought. So that's one aspect of the classical project on display today. But more interestingly, of course, is the Homeric hymn, the ode, the song to the voyage and the quest. And Ian, perhaps that's where we could start, because all your books are in some senses voyages and quests. You said those are the two journeys that are worth taking. But here there really is a transatlantic journey that links some of the sources of your inspiration with your life here in London.
Yeah, I was thinking when we were chatting beforehand, the excitement of a particular period in the 1960s, which is when I first came to live in London, the engagement that there was between the United States and Britain and between Britain and Europe. There were real bridges. It didn't need to be politically laid out or affiliated or spoken of. They were there in terms of the human cargoes that passed backwards and forwards. So a lot of the big American writers, people like Charles Olson, were doing a lot of research in somewhere like Dorchester, going out to Maiden Castle, spending long afternoons in strange provincial English hotels doing the Times crossword puzzle and playing the jukebox. And all that was sopping up, while at the same time, the young, sharp, bright English people were going off to Gloucester, Massachusetts. Someone like Jeremy Prynne was actually lodged in Olson's house, his flat there, and looking out over the Inner Harbour, and was providing him with the tools whereby to carry out this research. And I think we lost that. So the metaphor I planted in the first page of the book goes back to a fairly mythical figure called Prince Henry Sinclair, who apparently went from the Orkneys in the 14th century to America, voyaging, island hopping all the way along, and left his legend with the Indians who surround Gloucester as a figure called Glooskap, who becomes this tall, legendary figure. And I saw him stepping on the backs of whales all across the Atlantic. And then we lost that broke. And we became a sort of strange client state. We became like an aircraft carrier. And everything went sour. And I didn't really want to go into those territories until quite recently it became obligatory, in a sense, to launch again, launch new, you know, as an old person. I like that idea. I've never worked so hard as this year. It's killing, you know. I made the terrible mistake of taking on this 70 film program for my 70th birthday.
Yeah, we'll come on to that.
And as you say, I was doing a talk as a part of this, and somebody like you, not as well informed, got up to make the introductory speech and was kind of was reading something from Wikipedia or whatever, and said, you know, I believe you have written in your life a lot of books. I think you've actually written 18 books. I said, well, yes, this year. this is quite shameful in a sense. It's incontinent. But it did remind me of Anthony Burgess, because one of the first talks I gave in this was up in Manchester. And it was really good to be there, and it was in an Anthony Burgess centre. And beforehand, they took me around. And there were two really interesting things. One, all the books that he'd reviewed were shelved up. And one of these was my first sort of large novel, which was called Downriver, which he'd reviewed and was fairly scathing about. And I saw with interest that he'd only read about 7 pages. And he'd also reviewed Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, which was, they had a proof copy there, was completely misbound, and there was another book slipped into it, and it was a complete shambles, but he'd still reviewed it very well, off about 20 pages. And the final thing was all his typewriters, they just astonished, they were a stack of these portable typewriters in a glass cabinet, really, really beautiful. So recently there's been a series of installations and curations in Stoke Newington and the old Sea Cadets building by Test Centre, who are wonderfully active, bright young publishers in Hackney. And I was curating some archive stuff there, and there was a space left, and I suddenly thought I could put an old typewriter in there. And I got back home, and my wife was in the process of clearing the shed, and it was going into the skip, so I could rescue this thing, wrestled it in there, and it was beautiful, lit up. And they said, well, do you want to sell it? Because Mags Brothers, these very top-of-the-market antiquarian book dealers, bought this ancient typewriter. And so that's all down to the Manchester Anthony Burgess. And Anthony Burgess, when he wrote all these books in 1 year, was apparently dying. You know, he had this notion, which is something writers occasionally invent as a good ploy to buy time. And you write 4 or 5 books in a year, and it works. And then you live on for another 50-odd years afterwards.
Well, you do speculate, of course, in American Smoke that Robert Bolaño probably isn't dead, because he's producing at such a rate still.
Spiritually and metaphorically, I'm sure he's alive.
Very much so.
He's deeply alive to me. And his presence is one of the strands I tease through this book, because he fictionalized the lives of those American poets. Olson turns up in his Nazi Writers in America series, where he writes fictional, quasi-fictional biographies of a series of people. And it was the idea that someone could take poetry as the abiding essence of a life and a way of dealing with the culture and turn it into a sort of detective story. Made me use the same process and turn it on Bolaño, and to try and revisit where he'd lived and what you're revisiting is a written landscape rather than an actual landscape, but it's just as real. And I really do believe that digression is the quickest path to get to the truth, and that with him you see that. And when the book ends on the south coast of England, discovering there is somewhere called America Ground in Hastings, that actually this bunch of people, libertarians and anarchists and lowlife who were living in upturned boats and things, chose to become a state of America when they were threatened with clearance by the local landlords and authorities. They said, we are an American state. Mm-hmm. And they had an American flag with the shield of Hastings on it. And they stayed there for an extra 7 years till they were cleared away. And I thought, this is perfect. The whole thing comes back to your own doorstep. And it was like William Blake's America, a Prophecy, as if America was this prophetic land that you wanted to get to. So when I'm told that I can't do narrative, or narrative is not part of the matter, I would say that is simply not true, because what you're doing with narrative is working much more in terms of architecture and shape, that the book divides up through Jungian archetypes, essentially, that the first movement of the book are these large male embattled figures, culturally disaffiliated, disaffected, but very important, Olson, Kerouac, and so on. Then the second book, you move away through an old lady living in South London called Muriel Walker, who'd had a wonderful, fantastic life as a Jewish orphan from the East End, involved with all kinds of left-wing politics, a friend of the writer Alexander Baron. And then she gets caught up in the Italian film industry on an Anna Magnani film that's shot on a volcanic island. And all of this extraordinary story, which seems like a digression, is really very firmly embedded in the idea of volcano chasing, specific landscapes that we look for. And then that whole second movement then is this very much around the female archetype. Mm. And by the third book, you're going backwards and forwards by young male and female coming together, separating, splitting, getting lost. And in the last book, the elderly versions of the same thing come together and journey together and launch out on a new Homeric voyage. So all that is really constructed and intended. Absolutely. And it isn't just thrown together. It's not a beat memoir, because the Beats are now sort of like the Bloomsbury Group or the Crays. They're a heavy industry. And you can't do yet another history. I mean, when you come to the point where Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter is playing Allen Ginsberg in a sort of gay campus romance, it's moved to a place that is almost beyond resolution.
Yeah, exactly.
But I still would like to try and resolve it all the same.
Yeah. No, very much so. I mean, you mentioned Wales earlier and the ancestor Sinclair, shall we say, stepping on the backs of those cetaceans to get to the New World. But of course, if we think about the other Wales, that's where you come from, South Wales. And My Steg, which Robert Frank photographed, and that finds its way into the pages as well. But could you just take us back to the beginning, if you like, when you were a student and when certain books were purchased by you and your friend Chris Bamford at the same time in different places and became kind of wormholes into this projected space of America and the possibility it offered against what was then a very limited vision that the English cultural landscape offered?
Yeah, that analogy of the wormhole thing, I think, is very true. There was such a sense of excitement in that period because it was coming out of such ignorance. You know, the first pre-war period felt, which I was a child in and growing up out of, felt so clamped down and closed and mm-hmm. localized in lots of ways. And the writing was very much class-based that was here. We were seeing social satire. We were seeing aggrieved, ego-led narratives that were about people who were having a bad time because they couldn't get off with the industrialist's daughter and, you know, all this stuff. And then once they'd got it, they retreated to the country, to large houses, and then it became novels about divorce and drinking. And I wanted something with a larger reach, and then sort of coming across in Dublin Charles Olson's Distances, found in a department store on Grafton Street, and just astonishing. Mm-hmm. And two of us found the same thing the same day and rushed back with this strange material and launched a sort of quest, I suppose, to see where that came from, what it involved, and what the methods were. That the idea of open field poetics was very exciting. It was the idea that you would do an enormous amount of work and research, but at the end of the day, you were still pushed to get it onto the sort of Homeric curve, to bring it all back to myth and legend and quite simple, powerful truths that related to your own biology and your own body. Mm. And that I found there, which I wasn't finding here. Mm. But on the other hand, I didn't go to those landscapes. The accidents of a life bedded me down in East London, which was more than enough to deal with. I mean, just working, surviving, being, reading a city, and yet those things still haunted. And it felt very good at the moment when I wanted to step away from the local, which I felt was so changed, I needed to think about it in a different way, into this other landscape. This was exactly right to go back into this and make a voyage. I keep going back. It is that thing of the voyage where you meet monsters along the way, some in your past, some in your future. There are great encounters, like particularly, I suppose, the highlight was seeing Gary Snyder, who was, in terms of a voyage, here he is in the forest, high above in the Sierra Nevada, completely alone, and very demanding in how he would conduct an interview, that you had to arrive absolutely on the dot, that the principles of his Buddhist life were embedded, and then what was the nature of our conversation? It wasn't as easy as talking to you. You know, it was like, what do you want from me out of this? And, and what I wanted was to make a book. The writing of the book was the finding out of what the book was about. I couldn't really say that to him. So it became quite challenging, but also incredibly exciting. I kind of, could I read just a little?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
This is a little, and also I wanted to read that bit because the LRB magazine were generous enough to commission that encounter with Gary Snyder, which helped to make the journey possible for me. And the bit I'm going to read is when we were, after we'd got through this initial phase, Gary started to talk about what was going on in London. We discussed Edgelands. He had seen photographs of the huts of the Manor Garden allotments in the lower Lee Valley in East London before they disappeared to make way for our great Olympic Park. It's money for basically nothing, he said. This is the global against the local, absolutely. Semi-urban wilderness is valuable. What about Epping Forest? Have they left any of that? Epping Forest is too valuable to touch. It was touching to have Gary Snyder take notice of developments in Hackney, to see him align the enclosures with the grander landscape sweeps in Canada and Alaska and California. And he spoke of his love of John Clare, the Badger being one of his great marker poems. Driving down to his academic work at UC Davis, Snyder noticed another kind of urban edgeland. There's a big rice field flooded paddy near Sacramento Airport. It used to have a sign on it saying, "This field annually feeds 40,000 people, and that's export only. There are 1 billion people in China. The Japanese don't import so much rice. They've got their own subsidized industry, but they import wheat from Canada, and it goes out through Vancouver." "But we're re-inhabiting the land," Snyder said, his pinkies horizontal as he lifted a small cup between his two hands. "This was a high-priority place to live for the Indians. They were wiped out. There's only a few left. But they're still around, though. The valley is all marsh and wetlands. They go down there for the fishing and for the duck. The valley is covered in tule fog for quite a few weeks in the winter. It's very chilly. It's sunny up here. We're at the snow line. Higher up, there are deer all season. So the original inhabitants made their living in the rather benign foothills. Cooler than the valley, too. This is a benign place to live." Gary, they say, was wild if you caught him at the right time. There's been a lot of photographs over the years, from beards and sandals to black collarless jackets and motorbikes to alpine sunglasses against high peaks, a confident artisan of language ripe with paradox, monkish austerities, early libidinous pleasures, bathing pools and parties, as Kerouac reports, where San Francisco dignitaries, scholars, and art patrons were entranced by the Marin County retreat and their naked hosts, Ginsburg, Orlovsky, and Snyder. The stud in his left ear still strikes a jaunty note, narrowed eyes, thin spectacles perched on creased brow. The years press down a little, rounding out the shoulders under that dark blue shirt, as we walk across to inspect the library in the converted barn. But the stride is sure. Snyder is undeceived. He was tempted to use horses to pull the logs, but thought better of it. You can't live on this ridge without cars. Nobody can afford to become a farmer. You have to inherit the land. When the young folk come down from these hills, they just go to Portland and retire. Re-inhabiting and bio-visionary ideas are useful and practical and brilliant, but they don't catch on. It's not for the time. You can't sell voluntary simplicity to people. And that's what we're talking about, voluntary simplicity, or in some cases, downward mobility. The barn, open to daylight, is stacked with information, with books organized and not fetishized. Snyder stressed again, "I'm not a prose writer, I'm a poet. And that means when it hits me, I scribble a few things. And when I do my organized editing and classifying, I do it here and mostly in the morning, but not real early, because the first thing I do is that I meditate." chatting with this man, hands in pockets, Emmy, his dog, rubbing against his thigh, we appreciate that we've taken up enough of his programmed day. The long drive down 101, which will continue to San Francisco and then Los Angeles, has been about placing this meeting. We confront one another like polite but road-weary strangers in the middle of nowhere, nodding across red formica in some big breakfast bar, big U.S. flag outside, convenience stores shuttered along with the brass-plated bank. There's a piece in Danger on Peaks that's set on the road that we will drive. Snyder's sister, Anthea Corinne Snyder Lowry, noticed a pickup truck ahead of her had lost a grass mower from the back. She pulled onto the shoulder and walked right out into the lane to take it off. That's always been her way. Struck by a speedy car, an instant death.
You took us to the West Coast there with Gary Schneider, as opposed to Olson's Massachusetts. And if one thinks of another West Coast writer, Raymond Carver, a short poem of his exhorts us all to put it all in, to make use of everything that you might come across, your own life, the traces, the evidence, and so on. And Olson, of course, in a very different register, as also is Schneider, they do exactly that. They create this multifarious, multi-headed form that can accommodate everything in a way. The Maximus poems, of course, of Olson being the primary foundational example. But that space of America and the idea of writing as territory that you mentioned earlier was, of course, hugely attractive, as you said. But in terms of then visiting that space and actualizing it, making it real, driving the miles and eating at the diners, was there there was obviously a very productive creative tension in that because it led to the book. But what was the reality of that for you in terms of the imagined space?
The only reality of it at all was writing the book. The actual experience was totally unreal. It was dreamlike because we projected these landscapes and places for so many years, seen so many films, read so many books, that thing of driving is impossible. I mean, the drive itself had to become a film before it could become a drive. So that initially, my wife would drive the first couple of hours, and I was filming it, some of that has been downloaded onto an interactive version of the map now, which very nicely by Penguin. And the reality was walking, as always for me. So I invented a technique whereby I tried to reclaim the landscape that Albert Speer touched on in his insane project when he was in Spandau prison in Berlin, and there were only two of them left. He was doing this project of measuring precisely his walk around the prison yard by transferring beans from one pocket to another, measuring the length of his shoe, seeing exactly how far he'd walked, and translating that into real-world geography, because he got all the maps, and he then, in his own head, walked from Berlin across Germany, across Russia, the Bering Straits, and he's coming down America. So he's walking through the same landscape I'm walking. And he's writing vivid accounts of this and producing a sort of insane, epic novel, which was a model in a sense that I wanted to unpick and take out that sort of darkness of Europe and take it back by actually walking in the landscape. So every morning, wherever I was, I walked for the same 2 hours or whatever he'd walked around, just in a circle around these various towns and settlements wherever we were. So essentially that was much more the essence of the project, was the walking part of it. And then I found that all of the large figures I was interested in also had this idea of the epic walk, that the landscape leads itself to that. Gary Snyder very early on writes about how he felt strongly when he's on the oil tanker that he wants, when he gets ashore, to get up to Seattle where he'd grown up on a stump farm and walk right down the coast to San Francisco. He wanted to walk it. He never actually did walk all of it, but that was what he felt the shape should be. There's a moment when Kerouac, who's in Mexico City, believes that instead of being on the road in the cars with Neil Cassidy, he wants to walk back to New York, and he starts off and he actually walks towards the border. So those walks are just embedded in the American consciousness. And the model for Gary Snyder, and one I draw on, is Cabeza de Vaca, the Spaniard who ends up shipwrecked in Florida 1620s, and most of his compatriots die, and he's absolutely naked, and he gets involved with various Native American groups because he cures somebody who's ill by praying over them. He's taken to be a shaman, and they follow him, and he walks all the way from Florida to Mexico. And that was Snyder's model. He keeps referring back to that. Mm. And other figures refer back constantly to John Ledyard, who was an American who decided he was going to walk across Europe to the Bering Straits, etc. Well, all of that I knew. What I didn't know was that this was William Burroughs' dream, because you don't just think of Burroughs as being somebody who walks other than on small trajectories around cities with a Snoopy camera or whatever. So maybe I read a little fragment of Burroughs, because that took me quite by surprise that he fitted with this pattern. Burroughs made several entries in his dream diaries, noting how the European cities of the past were grafted onto the American wilderness, like Kerouac in 1947 and Snyder in 1957. Burroughs saw himself trudging impossible miles on nightmare journeys through real but transposed continents. Nazi coins made into blind spectacles badged him through sinister frontiers. I should just say what that reference is. This was, I was in a place called the Sylvia Hotel in Vancouver, which is one of those great ghost hotels, really much more resonant than the Chelsea Hotel. It's still a functioning place. And it's exactly where Malcolm Lowry, when he was at the Burrard Inlet in his squatter's hut, used to meet Dylan Thomas when he was on his reading tours, and they would drink. Well, we were staying there, and I met the writer William Gibson, who was very, very pertinent and sharp on all of this. And he told me that when Burroughs came through there for the last time, he also stayed in this hotel. And they had a rather terrible meal downstairs, and then they went upstairs, and Burroughs offered him a pharmaceutical pickup of his own choice. And he did the thing that police always do. He excused himself to go into the bathroom and have a poke around and see what was really going on. And he found got a strange kit. And he found an old Elastoplast tin, and he couldn't resist looking inside it. And inside it were these two black coins which had Nazi insignia on. And he thought, this is beyond weird. And so when he got the chance, he talked to one of the young men who was around with Burroughs and says, what is that about? And he said, well, Bill takes this tin everywhere, and when he dies, he wants these coins to be put into his eyes. So I thought, that's pretty good. So that's the Nazi spectacles. Bill said, I've walked across Siberia. It took me 2 months. I had to kill 5 people. New York is gone. I was astonished to see how closely the somatic diary of the beat senior citizen with his cats and his canes duplicated the model for the looped walks I was trying to undertake every morning of our Pacific Rim trip as a way of rolling up the deranged invasion path tramped and recorded by Albert Speer in the prison garden at Spandau. I have, it seems, walked across the Bering Strait, Burroughs wrote, across Siberia and northern Europe. Speer, Hitler's architect of ruins, successfully concluded a trial hike from Berlin to Heidelberg and set out through the long years of his imprisonment, having confirmed the length of his stride, to calculate the pedestrian progress across Germany, Siberia, and the Bering Straits to America, then down the Pacific coast to Mexico, achieving 35 kilometers south of Guadalajara before they let him out into an afterlife of self-justifying interviews. His activities were viewed with disdain by his fellow prisoners, a numbered rump of high Nazi officials, admirals, diplomats, delusionists, who were fortunate to escape the noose after the Nuremberg trials. The last prisoners left, numbers not names, were the compulsive fugue walker Speer, sweating out his swollen fantasies, and Rudolf Hess, the deputy leader of the party, survivor of a brain-cracked flight to Britain. Their relationship, hostile, jealous of history, a grudging alliance of shared solitude, was Beckettian and absurd. A pacer of dirt circuits and a watcher in the long coat, a madman or cynical sage. But it was Hess, the witness, who suggested the beans, that Speer should measure each circuit achieved by shifting a bean from one pocket to another like a cricket umpire, or like one of Beckett's Cartesian
pebble suckers on an Irish strand. My memory loss was faked, Hess boasted, faking it again for Spear, the ultimate faker, the man who almost convinced himself.
I mean, you mentioned the Vancouver Hotel, among many other things, but that's another kind of wormhole, isn't it? We have the books that are purchased at the same time. We have dates and venues that become portals into other spaces. And yeah. The book, as you rightly said, is incredibly tightly structured, and its narrative is just differently told. As Godard said, we have the beginning, the middle, and an end, but not necessarily in that order. Yeah. And so the book itself is riddled with a labyrinthine network of associations.
And with the nature, as Bolano said, all English writers aspire to write detective stories. And in a sense, this is true. This is a detective story. And he, mysteriously, is one of I think he and Malcolm Lowry, in different ways, are the guides. Malcolm Lowry guiding into the days of the dead and the past and almost rewriting his own novels repeatedly till he can't go on any longer. Mm. Whereas Bolano leads a magical tour that finishes up when I meet somebody in Highgate who starts telling me about knowing him and being astonished that he was a writer. You know, he seemed to be almost a derelict, a down and out on the edge of this group of exiles who met in Barcelona and drank, and he was very interested in comics and so on. And then suddenly he reemerges with these huge epic novels that achieve world fame. And yet he didn't see it. And yet he could give me the address of a couple of people who were friends of his, and they were reluctant to talk or reveal anything. But one guy, Rodrigo Frizan, sent me this novel he'd written about London. Mm. And it was set around J.M. Barrie and Kensington Gardens, and very, very extraordinary. And then after I'd read that, he said, did you realize that I and my wife are two characters in Bolano's novel, 2666? I said, no. He said, we're in it. So then I realized that actually the books are as much of a geography as the world, and possibly more so. So I immediately go to this book, and I find this scene in Kensington Gardens, and sure enough, this character is referenced. He's there, his wife is there. And there's a third party in the garden who is called Norton. And this kind of gives me something of a chill, because I have a kind of alter ego character called Norton, who was in a book called Slow Chocolate Autopsy, who is able to move through time but not through place. He's a prisoner of London. He can never escape. And this character is stolen by me from William Burroughs. It's the beginning of Junkie, the first sentence. This rather sleazy character called Norton turns up and introduces Burroughs to Junk, and so initiates that whole process. And my Norton goes through various sleazy adventures until he's picked up by Alan Moore and becomes a character in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So the lives beyond the lives that are in books are quite extraordinary. And to find this person turning up in London in this novel is exactly the first sentence that's in Slow Chocolate Autopsy, is that Norton was present in the garden. All of that, very odd. And then I thought, this is a very, very convincing portrait of London, very detailed. And and he said, yes, right down to a description of an angel tree in Kensal Green Cemetery, where there's a statue with the... I thought, that's quite familiar. And then I realized that actually it's a photograph that Mark Atkins took, which I pointed him at, in a book called Slow Chocolate Autopsy. And he said, yes, that's where I got it from. And I said, oh, my God. And so I said, well, how did you get this incredible sense of London? He said, well, when I was in London, I stayed in a Novotel alongside Heathrow Airport. I never went anywhere near London. I just got a suitcase of books and swallowed it all up, and that became London. And General Rudolph said, well, what the hell was I spending my time charging about America for? I could have just stuck with a suitcase of books that I started with and conjured the whole thing out of that. So the two processes are going on side by side, and it was a beautiful lesson at the end. And in that sense, Bolano was still alive and was teaching the final lesson, and he kind of dissolves away, and the book ends with the figure of the Andrew Cotting, the filmmaker who had accompanied me on a swan pedalo voyage from Hastings to Hackney at the beginning of the book, which I step away from to go off to America full circle, and Andrew sets off swimming, as he says,
down to Cornwall and leaves his boots and his bag on the shore. So there is a kind of beautiful circularity to the autumn sea and that moment of storms that comes round both ways.
Thank you, Ian. Just before we open it out, I mean, if I could
quote is the quote that I suddenly find in Bellano, which is, I would never get on a pedal boat built to look like a swan. Roberto Bellano.
So we're clearly in the presence of larger forces here. And yeah.
Coincidence is where you start. I mean, that's like, this is what Rodrigo Frizan said. You know, this is it. This is only the starting point. And if these coincidences do not occur, you're in the wrong place. Because it turned out the book he was now writing was about Malcolm Lowry, and he was using exactly the same sources as I'd been doing, and it led into we won't go down that.
But well, if we think of a presiding spirit, of course, of yours, J.G. Ballard, he wrote very acutely that deep assignments run through all our lives. There are no coincidences, and I know that next week you'll be taking a life-size cutout of J.G. Ballard to Toronto.
Yeah,
but.
Let's leave that hanging.
I'd just like to, before we open it out, I'd just like to quote from your quoting of Charles Olson. I take space in capital letters to be the central fact to man born in America from Folsom Cave to now. I spell it large because it comes large here, large and without mercy. And in a sense, everything you've mentioned now around the American writing speaks to that idea of how you occupy that space as a human being. And make it a place, if you like, and primarily the place of writing, or not least the place of writing.
Well, also being there, being in Gloucester, and living for a time in this hut, which Vincent Farini, who was a friend and arguing partner of Olson's, occupied as a framer of paintings and prints, you know, gave an astonishing sense of that space, that what they were involved with. We've seen them in terms of their large issues in Olson's ideas about Melville, and Olson's ideas, which he engages with in terms of Ed Dorn, of the American West, the space, the push. Actually, a lot of it came down to what was going on very specifically in Gloucester in terms of buildings being torn down, in cases of local corruption, and so on and so on. And there's a writer called Peter Anastas who's edited the letters that Olson poured out to the local papers, that it begins in the absolutely local. It begins in the fact of his own town and being able to walk about that town at night and being able to buy stuff and finding places disappearing and how you deal with that, you know, how you have to fight for every inch of ground that's local to you before you can open out to the world. And that was a lesson, to be in somewhere that was very, very immediate and proud of its own locality. And to find quite elderly people, even older than me, who had been at Black Mountain, turning up to a talk there in the museum just because they wanted to re-engage with that utopian ideal that floated at one period of time, and maybe we can go back to it, when they felt very cut off by what was going on there now, and the economic collapse and the bite and the breakup of the Portuguese community. All of those things were happening, and it begins just on the doorstep with what's happening on your own street.
Absolutely. This is our street. This is our time. Who would like to comment and respond, challenge, problematize any of the things that Ian has said? Anything to do with Ian's vast and wondrous body of work? Would anyone like to say yes? Gentlemen here, please.
Of the poets who write in what you correctly define as open forms, who do you think, or what works do you think will last?
You mean of the American poets?
Yes, of the American
ones?
Of the Americans, yeah.
That's not really a question. I mean, who lasts? Any history is going to tell that. So it's a stab in the dark. But for me, Ed Dorn, I think particularly is somebody who certainly will last, because he had such a sharp, bright, acerbic intelligence, and because he was so adept at finding an English and a European register, as well as having a great sense of the American West. So I think he learnt a lot from Olson and took it to a different place. And I think
I think Olsen is going to be there, someone to last as a model, and as a link and a big argument with Ezra Pound and the fathers of modernism and with William Carlos Williams. Obviously, there are numerous other poets within that register who I admire hugely. Whether their works last or not, we don't know.
I mean, it's strange that in America, the collected poems of Ed Dorn has not been published.
I know. I mean, it's very extraordinary. Very extraordinary. I don't understand that at all. I mean, I know he went out of fashion, sort of politically, towards the end. But once upon a time, Gunslinger was pretty well moving to the centre of things. Someone like Snyder has held on. I think certain poets, if you go back to the reading in San Francisco, the famous six gallery reading in which Ginsberg launched Howl, and Snyder was reading Berry Feast, that those the themes of ecology, the theme of urban apocalypse and meltdown, the two things sat there, and they formed strands that were very, very influential. Michael McClure, who's read at this shop several times, was also reading there. And I think if you didn't manage somehow to establish an identity, you could drop off the map, because one of the things I'm interested in the book is looking at the people who missed. People like Lou Welch, who was a great friend of Gary Snyder's and who just disappeared into the forest, leaving a note behind him and was never found. When I was with Gary Snyder, I'd actually forgotten that took place actually at Gary Snyder's place in Sierra Nevada. And I asked him where it was that Lou Welch had been. He said, right here. This was his car. I found it, and there was a note in it, and we searched for 5 days, and there was never a sign of him. He'd kind of vanished. But Lou Welch lived with difficulty, lived with a sense of the impossibility of a role for the poet within that society, or how much of an outcast he felt himself to be. And someone like John Wieners as well, who is much quoted, I think he had that sense of being an outcast figure. And you know, we can see in England, I think there are tremendous open field poets who learnt a lot from this. People like Bill Griffiths and Alan Fisher obviously applied the same lessons to writing about London and created huge works which are not really acknowledged still by mainstream culture.
Mm. Thank you. I mean, I think one of the issues of the book is about poetry as a form of resistance, isn't it? Because, as you say very early on, as it becomes ever more obscured by the mainstream drive of the culture and the society, so it becomes ever more necessary, of course, and ever more
there's the other imperative that comes out of the culture is to, as I said, with the Bloomsbury Group or the Craze, that was sort of mocking version, but there is an imperative to try and commodify them so that you get on the road, finally becomes a movie, and it's like a travelogue about somebody researching on the road, and as a documentary about jeans and cars. And so the lives of them become more and more and more in the public domain, whereas nobody feels the obligation to do the hard thing of reading the books or reading all the books. And then they're now massive entities as a projection, but not as a reality. And I think that is just one of the facets of life, that we need to get people who will actually take the trouble to go back and see what they were on about, what they wrote, what they did, rather than the accidents of the William Burroughs shooting his wife and so on and so on. Which is why I was really pleased that you showed the Gary Wolkoff's Beat film at the Whitechapel Gallery, because it is in itself a kind of a poetic recovery. I mean, it deals with the myths of their lives, but it does it in a way that is sort of awkward and tender in some ways. It's not to do with exploiting the mythology.
I mean, you mentioned Test Centre earlier, and I suppose this is crucial, isn't it, to Ed Dorn's presence here, to fugitive presses, small presses who take the poets on and put the books out.
Who's publishing Ed Dorn here now before this? Nicholas Johnson, with a very, exactly, very small press now based in Hastings, Etruscan Books, you know. Who sees them? And Ed Dorn, a major poet, is prepared to put books out through this tiny little English press.
It's only when Carcanet finally do the big roundup, but that's quite a long time afterwards.
But one of the moving elements of the book is this idea of a generational relationship. Yourself, much younger, speaking to Ginsberg for Kodak Mantra Diaries. Now, you know, Test Center.
The same way Ginsberg speaks to Dylan Thomas. You know, there's a wonderful awkward encounter in New York when, because Dylan Thomas, who was the first poet that I sort of seriously studied and wrote about while I was in school and went to research and meet people who knew him, do all this stuff on my own home ground. The figure of America was like a terrible balloon cloud that hung there. This guy who went seriously wrong and drank himself to death. But when you get into the detail of it, he becomes the prefigurer of a lot of the Beat generation. He's on the road. He's doing huge numbers of readings. He's traveling backwards and forwards across the country endlessly. And when he's in a bar in New York, Allen Ginsberg is in there as a young guy and sees him and sort of gets into an awkward, forced conversation with him. And when he's going away in a taxi, sticks his head through the window and puts his tongue out. How weird. And yet that passage, the link between him and that, and then the Dylan's name passing on to Bob Dylan, you know, the links were there. And it began in Wales, or with a Welsh poet who had this huge sense of aura and presence, reading these poems publicly right backwards and forwards across New York. That started the business of public readings that the Beats later come in on.
Very good. Thank you. Would anyone else like to comment? Yes, gentleman at the back, you might have to project or wait for the mic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm interested in that idea of connections that you just mentioned, that there is a link between everybody. And I haven't read the book yet. It's on, you know, I'm getting it for a Christmas present. But right at the end, you mentioned about Black Mountain. So I don't know whether there's anything in the book about Black Mountain, but I've read quite a lot about it. And I wondered whether there was any sense of any connection between people like Cage, Rauschenberg, you know, the emigres who ended up at Black Mountain, and what you're writing about in the book.
Yeah, in fact, Black Mountain appears right on the first page of the book. So you won't have to get too far to come across it. It's, where are we? The largest, most light occulting of all the giants of that earlier race was Charles Olson, poet, scholar, last rector of Black Mountain College. This establishment, a scatter of buildings beside a lake in North Carolina, now imploded, bankrupt, seemed to us a Valhalla of all the talents, Joseph Albers, John Cage, Merce Cunningham, William de Kooning, Robert Rauschenberg, Buckminster Fuller, Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, Ed Dorn. You pick up the traces any way you choose through fugitive magazines and literary gossip, and they all lead back to this one place. So Black Mountain was completely central. It was an inspirational idea that all of those multiple talents could be in one place, even though by the time Olson gets there, it's imploding. It's all economically collapsing. It's in a state of huge creative tension. And the response to that here is that as absurd young poets ourselves, we dreamt about founding some similar thing in England. And in the second part of the book, there's a description of a journey. You go to Cambridge to see Jeremy Prynne and sort of suggest he becomes rector of a English Black Mountain College, which he was very obliging and courteous about.
And now, just this year, we've seen an MIT Press edition come out. The kind of the sort of the tombstoning on one level of the Black Mountain Project, but also, of course, a huge celebration of an extraordinary moment. I think only had 1,200 students in its entire life. Very few of them graduated, whatever that might have meant from Black Mountain College. But of course, the lineup of alumni and staff was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And in the book, when you go to Prynne with Chris Bamford, and you talk about this idea, which, of course, as you say, doesn't materialise, but the dream is so large that, in a sense,
it does sort of occur in things like the Anti-University, exactly, which sets up in Shoreditch. You know, the similar notions were current. This idea that you bring in all the talents, and it kind of works because the economic background to it
collapses, but for a brief time, I think they can generate enormous energy. Mm. And I think the defining thing in London, that the Congress, the Dialectics of Liberation, where all of these people turn up in Camden Town in the Roundhouse for a brief period of time, was a version of that, was like a kind of three-dimensional version. Violent arguments, all kinds of absurdities, but nevertheless, the inspiration of that runs on in London for a long, long time afterwards.
And we're sitting, obviously, in an important bookshop, and Camden is the site of, obviously, of perhaps the most important bookshop in your life, Compendium Books, which brought, literally, these volumes to the heart of the city and changed the kind of psychometrics of the culture by their presence. And this sense, I suppose, of which comes through very strongly in the book, of the protagonists, the poets, the writers, the artists, and so on. But then, crucially, the kind of the second, third, fourth ripples, the publishers, the recorders, the witnesses, is a very strong. It's a complete ecosystem, isn't it?
It has to be the complete system, or it doesn't work. Mm. You know, the thing of the visionary poet or whatever, it has to connect up. I mean, it was very interesting. at the Sea Cadets building again at the weekend, Lee Harwood and Tom Raworth read with Thurston Moore and a young Scottish woman poet, MacGillivray, really quite an astonishing span. And Lee Harwood was talking about he had been the manager at Better Books in Charing Cross Road, which put on readings by Allen Ginsberg, put on performances of many extraordinary kinds, and he used to invite penniless poets to actually go away with a bunch of books and sell them up the road to Foyles, you know, just to keep themselves alive. They were an ecosystem. And then Lee goes on down to Brighton, where Public House Bookshop was run by Bill Butler, and tries to carry on the same thing there. And it works. It's wonderful. But the interpersonal things that are involved in running those kind of bookshops, unless there's some serious financial backing, it tends to fall apart in a period of time, and Lee Harwood ends up as a counter clerk in a post office, which he prefers because it frees his mind to do the important thing, which is his own work. And yet here he is, you know, someone like poets like John Ashbery are coming to stay in off Brick Lane with Lee Harwood in the early 1960s. It's exciting, those exchanges, and exactly as you say, the ripples that come off. There's somebody like Stuart Montgomery with Fulcrum Press. Somebody seems to be found to carry out the duty of publishing, managing, getting the books into the world, to the point where in the 1960s, Jonathan Cape, were prepared to absorb Goliard, who was a small press run by Tom Raworth, and you get Cape Goliard, you get Cape Editions, these tiny little books being run by the poet Nathaniel Tarn, bringing out, amazing structures of European and American stuff. If that doesn't happen, the culture stagnates. And it did happen at that time.
I mean, just to mention Stuart Montgomery, there's a wonderful passage, which I won't spoil for readers, about his journey to Las Vegas to see a certain Howard Hughes. Yes. But it ends with this wonderful observation that you make, that it was that craziness we used to call the possible.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, in a sense, the nutshell of the whole project, isn't it? The possible remains.
Well, can you imagine now a London small press publisher, say, deciding that he's going to go and see Rupert Murdoch to get him to denounce his poet, in that case Ed Dorn, in his newspaper, so that we could sell a few copies in London Review of Books. I mean, this is the art of the impossible.
Are there any more questions? Yes.
We'd like to say a few words. Hello, sir. I wonder if you could say a few words about your methodology, whether you had an itinerary, and whether you did your reading beforehand, or whether the itinerary developed as you went along, and the reading as you encountered these books in bookshops on your way.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I did the reading about 50 years before I started the journey. So the reading was my past, was my cultural memory, although obviously I read afresh at the same time. And the journeys are really also the journeys of a lifetime, because it opens with a relatively current journey when I was invited to go to Gloucester, Massachusetts, to give a talk, which which I jumped at because it gave me time to look into the background of Charles Olson, whose books I'd all read many, many years ago. So the books were read. The place was then visited, and going to the place, I had a very firm idea of things I needed to look at and wanted to look at, but I also stayed open to the people I met and the opportunities that arose through that. For example, that in the local library there, I didn't realize that Olson's own books had just gone onto the open shelves of the library, and people were taking out books and discovering annotations by him were still there. And I found a book about D.H. Lawrence's paintings with unrecorded Olson poems and things like that. So there was an element of that off-the-cuff research. There was also an element of knowing where I was going to go, but there was also a recording of earlier journeys. Like in the mid-90s, I went for the BBC, did a radio program generating the beats, going to visit Corso, Ginsberg, Burroughs, Ferlinghetti, McClure, all of that, and recalling that particular journey, which is something that's already happened. And in the big journey this time was based around researching in Vancouver and traveling down the West Coast, which I didn't know at all. And as I went, I would acquire books and I would meet people, and I'd set up already to talk to Snyder and to talk to McClure again in San Francisco and to visit the poet Tom Clark. Certain things were set up. Everything else just unraveled as it unraveled.
Oh, I just wanted to ask how it was coming back to London, if actually all the time before you've been in London. When I go away, I often find the way I look at where I come from has changed, and the contours seem to have changed. And I just wondered how it affected you coming back, or what you made of it, or when there, maybe.
I think it felt good to be back. I think it was... When I'd left, I was feeling disgruntled with a lot that had been going on around me, and I'd felt embattled in a particular way, and I thought everything that was happening, in a sense, was depressing. And then having made this trip and returning, I felt very re-energized by what was on my own doorstep, and I felt much, much more optimistic, and I could see things evolving and just taking new forms and moving on in an interesting way. And the more I've seen and the more I've been doing recently in terms of projects with the 70 film program in places like Hackney Wick and on canals, I can really see sort of life seeping back in good ways. And the sort of things that Gareth Evans has been involved with, and events in bookshops in Clapton, all of that, there's a real sense of renewal. And so London became a new place by having been away. I think that was very good from that point of view. One of the pieces I took out of the book was a big chapter about W.G. Sebald. I kind of felt it was a way of re-looking at London. I wanted to trace his journeys through Whitechapel when he was writing Austerlitz by the guidance of his friend Stephen Watts, the poet. So I did all that stuff, and yet I felt it didn't belong. So it came out of the book in the end and became a separate publication. But this was kind of a new London by way of having done it.
I mean, following on from that and this idea of the cinema project, which for I'm sure everyone does know, but Ian was 70 in June and was invited to curate a 70 film programme, which will finish just before his 71st birthday next June. And it takes in all sorts of venues, as you said at the beginning, and myriad films. And it's an extraordinary project. But, of course, what it does do for those of us who are your readers is take us back to your origins in cinema as a filmmaker, as a student who came to London and studied at the London School of Film Technique. That was your reason to come to the city in the first place. And it makes us rethink, I think, as Sukhdev Sandhu mentioned in a very good review of this book for The Observer, the origins of experimental writing in avant-garde film. Stan Brakhage, Kenneth Anger, and many others.
Yeah. Well, Stan Brakhage, obviously, in particular, was very, very closely associated with Michael McClure, was in deep correspondence with Charles Olson, made portraits of Robert Creeley, that the filmmakers and the poets were, they, I mean, he saw himself as a film poet, quite rightly. And, you know, I recognized his work very early on as being that and being part of the same living tradition. And you it took a while to realize that all of these various elements I was interested in did connect up, that the people knew each other, they interacted, and they'd often collaborated in various ways.
But the language of cinema coming into the writing is really crucial to how you construct, literally line by line, isn't it? The idea of the edit. Could you talk a little bit more about
that? Yes, I mean, I think I learned quite a lot about editing in terms of prose editing by working closely on the four essay fantasy films with Chris Pettit and Emma Matthews. Emma Matthews, very, very good visual editor in terms of seeing what you take out. I think, you know, that something can open up and move and find a necessary shape by slicing stuff out. Whereas my impulse is always to pour it all in. And huge advances are made when you clean it up. We saw the film Godard's Le Mépris last night at the ICA. It was one of the films. And what was interesting was to watch a black and white documentary about the making of the film and realizing how incredibly cluttered everything was in reality. It was a mess. It was hundreds of people, lots of stuff. And when you get the film, it's so spare, so cleaned out. You've got these bare spaces in which people are together with one piece of statuary, a window, you know, a lamp standard. That the art is stripping it out so that you get to essence. And you know, I'm still working on that. But I think also you don't need to be afraid to include a lot of material as long as there are these organic links that keep it moving. Mm. It doesn't have to be that sort of cliffhangery structure. And I think we've got it towards a very banal cross-cutting in terms of a lot of writing that's really like soap opera, that you have two different groups of people. This one gets to a point where you don't know what you're going to do, so you move to the other one and you go tick-tock, as if there's a very low boredom threshold and you need to keep that form of cutting. And I don't think you do. Mm. And the way I've learned is essentially from cinema, I would say, completely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Well, we've probably got time for a couple more questions, if anyone would like to. Yes, gentlemen there. Do please, if you could, wait for the microphone. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to ask a question about Bolaño. I suppose I just sort of find it surprising to have him in the same book as the beat writers. Not sort of quickly think of a lot more dissimilarities than similarities, and just really what it was that made you sort of put him in with them.
Poetry. No, I don't. I don't think it has to be similar. I don't think he's a similar kind of writer. I just think he's a very interesting figure, and this is not a book about beat writers. This is, as we've been trying to say, it's a voyage into a particular territory and my own cultural markers over a very long period of time, which included particularly Kerouac and Ginsberg and Burroughs, but also Dylan Thomas, Malcolm Lowry, and now Bolaño. And the Bolaño aspect is to do with migration and otherness. It comes out of talking to someone in Highgate, but he's talking about a man in exile in Barcelona. And when you go back into Bolaño, there's, as I said, there's this piece that he writes about a character who supposedly meets Charles Olson and is very influenced by him, who he's very satirical about. He doesn't like Charles Olson very much, but the connections are actually there. And again, Charles Olson is not a beat writer, but Kerouac wants very much to meet Olson. And that's one of the big kind of climax scenes in the first part of the book, is when Kerouac, towards the end of his life, very, very drunk and out of it, decides he's got to go and see Charles Olson and John Updike in one day. He never gets further than Olson. And it's a
pretty good a fiasco. But the things that you think don't connect really, really do. And Bolano, I was engaged with simply because I was reading his books quite avidly through the whole period, and he kept appearing by way of other people, floated him at me. And I like with him the relation between the reality of the people he knew, the characters he's mythologized, and the fictive reality that I'm not sure what the status is. I don't know. And I wanted to reflect that somewhat in the book.
Are there any more questions or comments at all? Yes, gentleman there, and then we'll...
You mentioned Nazis here and there, and you use the figure of Albert Speer, and then there's the Nazi coins on Burroughs' eyes. I mean, what is it about Nazis? How do they get into the book?
How do they get out? You know, they seem to be there. You know, it wasn't particularly my intention to bring them in. But the story that William Gibson told me was so striking, I immediately became haunted by it. And previously, again, the Muriel Walker, who's a communist, left-wing Jewish figure in London, had given me diaries of an Italian publisher, which led me into the same world where we found yourself crisscrossing with these figures, and the idea of the walk became quite obsessive to me, the idea of that piece of geography that you walk around while you're in prison that then opens out to become the whole world became a symbol of the book, and the idea that he does create this huge mad book from it while trying to dissociate himself from his own past, and instead of that talking about seeing American films and reading books by Robert Walser or whatever. It's very strange to know the status of what's going on, which is what I like.
In terms of writing this book now and meeting and going to the territories of lifelong concerns, what does it mean now in terms of wrestling with and thinking about those influences from now on into future books? They're always present.
Yeah, I mean, one book always leads into the possibility of another, or not. We haven't reached this absolute end game yet. So having done this, there's always a sort of slight hook at the end, which suggests ideas that I would like to go into for the next one, which would be much further out again, but would draw on things I've discovered here, people I've known here. Every time you finish one, it's a new map. The sheet is wiped clean, although obviously there's a residue, a burden of stuff that you carry with you. Mm. And I can see now that there's another series of journeys or voyages or whatever that would literally come out of this book and couldn't exist without it. Mm. And that's the way it's worked all along. I mean, this book is really a mirror image of the Hackney book. We've even got the same cover, the design of the cover, which becomes a map, is by the same person. So instead of having that couple of square inches of moss, as Lou Welsh says, you could read the world from an inch of moss on a rock, you could also open that out to become the world, to become a huge new territory that is oceanic, mountain range, is the world vision of ecology that Gary Snyder has. Mm. And the way that all those people on the Pacific Rim look east, they're much more connected to Japan and China than they are to what's going on in the other parts of America or in Europe. Mm. So all of those ideas are now cooking, yeah, hopefully, for another book.
Very good. Well, just before we close, I'd just like to read a very short poem that was found in Charles Olson's papers after he died. And as Ian says, quoting the poem, a fragment that was the whole. Now I begin to go. Hear me. I have sent you the message. I am gone. And as Ian says, he is going off to the wider journey, to the wider ripple, for the next book. But, of course, there are many books of Ian's here, as we flagged up at the beginning. The Hydra Breathes, just in front of us here. Pamphlets, fugitive publications, official publications, counter-publications, all or any of which Ian is very happy now to sign. But before he does that, I'd just like to flag up, of course, that there are more events still in the LRB shop calendar for this year. Next week, a friend and a fellow traveller of Ian's, Ken Walpole, will be here with a co-author of Ian's, Rachel Lichtenstein, to talk about the new English landscape, a landscape that we all inhabit, whether we know it or not, a hybrid landscape between the sublime and the post-industrial. A lovely publication to go with that. That's here next Thursday at 7 o'clock. And then after that, we enter the zone of mustard variations. Not that far from mushroom. I mean, mushrooms have many variations, but mustards have many, and apparently we can sample those at a number of late openings on the 4th, the 11th, and the 19th of December, where food and drink will be available. 10% off will also be available on all purchases, and Bark-style mustard variations will be sampling themselves, and we can sample them as well, should we wish to, on those dates, the 4th, the 11th, and the 19th of December. But before then, of course, do please join me in thanking all the LRB shop staff for enabling this event, but of course, Ian Sinclair for sharing his thoughts with us. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.